By downloading or listening to this podcast, you are agreeing to Moody's legal terms and conditions found at moodys.com/disclaimer, including that the information provided is not investment or financial advice, and that Moody's will not be liable for losses arising from your use of the information.
I'm Danielle Reed, and this is Moody's Talks, Focus on Finance. In today's episode, as we continue to explore fallout from Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we'll look at some effects sanctions on Russian entities and assets are having on aircraft leasing companies and also on asset-backed securities that are backed by aircraft leases. Later, from London, my co-host Miles Nelligan will talk to insurance team analyst Helena Kingsley-Tompkins about Tesla, and specifically about the electric car maker's innovative push into auto insurance. Miles, thanks for joining.
It's a pleasure, Danielle. Nice to be back.
So Miles, with fuel prices up pretty sharply, and that's also an effect of the military conflict in Ukraine, interest in electric cars is also surging. And Tesla's not just capturing interest in its cars, it's also capturing lots of driving data, and that data has allowed it to start offering auto insurance.
Yeah, that's right. As Helena says in her recent report, the company is currently offering car insurance in 5 US states, targeting its own customers, but has plans to roll it out to many more states by the end of this year.
So what's the risk to insurance companies from Tesla and from any other automakers that might decide to follow suit?
Well, right now, the competitive threat is pretty small, and there are a number of reasons why you might not see automakers decide in the future to take on a large amount of underwriting risk. Insurance still has quite high barriers to entry, large capital requirements, and high regulation, for instance.
I see. So where would a competitive threat come from then for insurers?
Well, if other electric vehicle makers decided to copy Tesla's insurance model, that would create more competition. But also, it seems quite likely that over time, insurance premiums will shrink overall. And that's simply because newer cars like Tesla's have a lot of safety features that didn't even exist 10 years ago.
I see. So the new smart cars that tell you when you're getting too close to the car in the next lane, for example, those smart features are just reducing the number of accidents overall. So there's lower risk and therefore lower premiums for the whole industry.
That's right. That's among the topics that Helena will be addressing in a few minutes.
Thanks, Miles. I'm really looking forward to hearing how Tesla is making its mark on car insurance. But first, joining me now in New York is banking team analyst Mark Wasden, here to talk about the effects different kinds of sanctions on Russian entities are having on aircraft lessors. Mark, welcome back to Focus on Finance.
Hi, Danielle. It's good to be back.
So, quick background. Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which started February 24, is ongoing. And it has led to multiple sanctions on Russian businesses and assets, which have sharply restricted the country's aviation sector. Several countries have banned Russian airlines from their airspace, and the EU has passed a regulation that includes a ban on aircraft leasing in Russia by EU-based leasing companies. What does this mean for the aircraft leasing companies we rate?
Well, Danielle, under the sanction regulation, EU-based aircraft leasing companies are now required to cease leasing of aircraft to Russia-based airlines by March 28th. Now, to put this into context, about 980 commercial aircraft are operated by Russian carriers, according to aviation consultant Cirium. This is out of a global commercial aircraft fleet of about 25,000. So aircraft operated by carriers in Russia represents about 4 to 5% of the global commercial aviation market. A high percentage of the aircraft in Russia are leased, about 80%. 515 are leased by and through leasing companies and entities based mainly in Ireland, and which are affected by the EU sanctions. The aircraft leasing companies that we rate account for about 250 of these 515 aircraft, but this represents just 1.6% to 7% of the book value of the fleets of the individual leasing companies.
So Russian aircraft are a relatively small share from the perspective of the aircraft leasing companies' Moody's rates.
Yeah, that's right. Now, of course, in the near term, the leasing companies will suffer a loss of rental revenues, about roughly 5% on average. and we'll need to find new leasing customers for any repossessed aircraft, probably at lower rates. They will also incur maintenance and other costs associated with retrieving the aircraft and making them ready for new customers. Longer term, they'll also likely need to impair the value of aircraft that cannot be recovered and redeployed. But because the exposures of the major leasing companies to Russia are low, and because they have strong capital and liquidity resources, we believe that they'll be able to manage the negative effects of this situation on their financial profiles.
Will the leasing companies be able to recover their aircraft in Russia?
Well, Cirium estimates that about 15% of the aircraft leased to Russia-based carriers have either already been repossessed or are in the process of being repossessed. But we expect that the probability of further successful recoveries of aircraft is very low. And this is because the Russian government placed a moratorium on returning leased aircraft to lessors effective March 6th. And in recent days, has also passed legislation creating a way for Russian airlines to re-register leased aircraft in Russia and obtain Russian airworthiness certificates, allowing them to continue operating the aircraft. Now, as an offset to non-recovered aircraft, lessors will be able to recognize as income the lease deposits, including cash and letters of credit, as well as maintenance reserves that they hold on the leased aircraft, which together represents about 15 to 20% of the value of the aircraft at risk.
I see. So what's the effect on leverage of the write-offs of aircraft?
In our report, we looked at the effect on debt-to-equity leverage of both a 50% write-off scenario as well as a 75% write-off scenario, and found that for the investment-grade leasing companies, even in a 75% write-down scenario, the negative effects on leverage could be remediated within a reasonable time, say 2 years.
Okay. And you say in your report that the leasing companies are also insured against the risk that their aircraft are confiscated. Will these policies offset the leasing companies' losses?
Well, we're not sure. The lessors have both possessed coverage, that is, insurance coverage for aircraft in lessors' possession and not covered by airline lessees, as well as contingent coverage that covers things like aircraft confiscation risk. The policies held by the airlines and reinsured by EU-based insurers are no longer in effect because the underlying leases have been terminated and coverage has been moved to the lessors' possessed policies.
The lessors don't actually have possession of many of these aircraft, even though they're supposed to have it under their contractual rights, correct?
Well, that's right, and that could be an issue, or it could add to the lessors' grounds for claims. In general, there has been limited transparency regarding the specific terms and conditions and insurer defenses under these policies. The lessors, however, believe that they have solid grounds for submitting successful claims because they were required to terminate the leases under the EU sanction regulation and have yet been unable to secure the return of most aircraft, as I noted before. Also, the Kremlin's moratorium on the expatriation of leased aircraft and passage of legislation that allows Russian carriers to continue to operate the leased aircraft even without the consent of the lessors has likely strengthened lessors' claims for losses. But we expect that claims will be subject of protracted, even years-long litigation, and that as a result, both the timing and amount of payouts is unpredictable at this point.
And what about in the longer term? What are the risks if the military conflict goes on for a while?
Well, as I noted in the report, should the conflict escalate, whether by involvement of NATO countries or invasion by Russia of neighboring states, and therefore becomes more entrenched, it could have a much more deleterious effect on the aviation industry as a whole, and would therefore have much more significant consequences for the lessors. This is not my current expectation, but is certainly something that we're tracking day to day.
Thanks, Mark. And joining us now is Gideon Lubin of the Structured Finance team, who can talk about what the sanctions on Russian businesses and assets mean for asset-backed securities, or ABS, backed by aircraft and related leases. Gideon, thanks for joining the show.
Hi, Danielle. Thanks for having me.
So, Gideon, how are sanctions on Russian businesses affecting ABS backed by aircraft and related leases?
Well, there are a few effects. ABS exposed to aircraft on lease to Russian airlines are vulnerable to lower aggregate lease rents as a consequence of early lease terminations and repossession risk. You see, some ABS portfolios have higher exposure to Russian airlines than that of the lessors' managed pools. And, as discussed with Mark, under the sanctions, EU lessors have generally terminated leases to Russian airlines. While many aircraft lease ABS sponsors are headquartered outside of the EU, the securitization vehicles that purchase, own, and lease the planes are often domiciled in Ireland, an EU member state, where they benefit from favorable tax treatment.
I see. So because they're domiciled in the EU, in Ireland, they have to terminate the leases.
Right. Now, in the normal course of business, after a lease termination, the servicer would typically recover the aircraft and either find a new lessee or sell the aircraft with a portion of the sales proceeds used to pay down the notes. But for the reasons Mark detailed, the Russian airlines whose leases were terminated early aren't likely to give up the aircraft in a timely manner, if at all. And if the aircraft are not returned, these assets would no longer provide cash flows to the transaction, and the servicer wouldn't have the ability to liquidate the aircraft to offset those losses. The deals typically required lessor insurance that is expected to cover certain war and confiscation risks. However, as Mark mentioned, in this instance, these claims will likely take years to reach resolution and may never pay out. So the combined impact of the lease terminations and uncertainties around repossession of the aircraft is reduced cash flows to the ABS.
And just to dimension the scope of the problem, Moody's rates 7 aircraft lease-backed ABS deals issued after the onset of the pandemic, How many are exposed to Russian aircraft leases?
Good question. Of the 7 aircraft lease ABS we've rated since 2021, 3 are exposed to aircraft leased to Russian airlines, and the exposures range from about 10 to 20% of the most recently reported adjusted base values.
What are some of the features of the ABS that could help mitigate the reduced cash flows?
Well, the first line of defense in the transaction structure are liquidity facilities. These are typically sized to cover 9 months of interest if there are any shortfalls from the reduced rent, and can also be used for unpaid transaction expenses and maintenance. Also, some deals include a reserve that provides similar liquidity to the most junior notes. And then, generally speaking, credit enhancement on the more senior notes, in the form of over-collateralization and subordination, can absorb losses in a more permanent impairment scenario. Over-collateralization is the amount that the value of the aircraft exceeds the outstanding note balance, and subordination is the protection provided by junior notes to which losses would first be allocated. The standard industry measure of this protection is the loan-to-value ratio, or LTV. At close, most senior notes have LTVs ranging from 60 to 70%, and the second priority note LTVs range from 70 to 75% based on the reported aircraft maintenance adjusted base values.
Got it. So liquidity facilities and credit enhancement provide pretty significant protections. Is there anything else?
Yeah. So when the deals are performing as expected, any lease rent received is typically shared pro rata between the note holders and equity holders, and that limits any note deleveraging. So to protect senior note holders when credit conditions deteriorate, the deals also typically have triggers that change the priority of payments to a sequential structure, where the most senior notes are paid down first and equity last. The triggers are typically based on, for example, measures of debt coverage, aircraft utilization, number of aircraft remaining, and percent of the scheduled collections received, all over a defined look-back period. Now, on the asset side, pool diversity also provides some protection. The pools are diverse both in terms of geographic exposure and exposure to specific airlines. This diversity limits the risk to any one airline or jurisdiction, but, as noted earlier, ABS deals typically have more concentrated exposures than the lessors' managed portfolios.
Thanks, Gideon. And Mark, thank you also very much for your insights. I'm now joined by my co-host Miles Nelligan in London, who will be speaking to insurance team analyst Helena Kingsley-Tompkins about how electric vehicle maker Tesla is moving into the U.S. auto insurance market.
Thanks very much, Danielle. And Helena, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Miles. It's great to be here.
Now, Tesla's become a household name over the past few years due to its eye-catching and highly futuristic range of electric vehicles. But what's probably less well known about the company is that in the US at least, it's also emerging as an innovative force in the insurance industry. Helena, can you talk us through what exactly Tesla is doing on this front?
Yeah, sure. So Tesla has actually been offering motor insurance in the US since around 2019. But as you might expect from a tech-led firm like Tesla, this is insurance with a 21st century twist. And specifically, the company uses sensors embedded in Tesla vehicles to monitor driver behavior. So this includes indicators such as frequency of hard braking and forward collision warnings. And these allow Tesla to assess accident risk with a pretty high degree of accuracy, and then to tailor its premium prices to the individual habits of each individual customer.
That's interesting. Does that mean Tesla drivers get a good deal on their insurance?
So that's definitely the idea. And according to the company, the average Tesla driver could pay between 20 and 40% less than they would to a traditional insurer. And this saving potentially rises up to 60% for the very safest drivers. And Tesla is, you know, confident of its insurance product. It's currently available in 5 US states. And the company plans to roll it out so that at least 80% of Tesla owners in the US will have access to it by the end of the year.
Tesla's underwriting model sounds familiar, Helena. Isn't it substantially the same as telematics insurance, where the insurer monitors driving habits through a device that they install in the customer's car?
You're right. It is the same basic idea as telematics insurance, which in fairness has been available for over a decade. I think the key difference is that the sensors that Tesla uses to collect driving data form an integral part of the car's design. And this means that they can pick up perhaps richer and more accurate data than a single device placed within the vehicle could. Now, of course, most new smart cars, so vehicles that collect and communicate data via the internet, now have similar technological features as Tesla vehicles. So if traditional insurers find a way to access this data, then the difference is not so significant. But Tesla's approach has some other benefits too. For example, in-car cameras and sensors can quickly establish who is at fault in an accident, which cuts the risk of fraud and reduces the claims processing costs, which are both pretty high for the motor insurance industry.
So it sounds like Tesla's insurance business has some advantages. And I guess the key question here is, are traditional car insurers starting to get worried?
Tesla's approach definitely has some innate benefits, but the direct competitive threat to traditional insurers is still limited. And that's because Tesla's business model depends on data that only Tesla vehicles can generate. So it predominantly insures its own cars, which account for only a small share of the overall motor market. Now, of course, there is a risk that as smart cars become more widespread, large car manufacturers could start offering insurance using this same tech-led underwriting approach.
It's often said that the insurance industry has thin margins and high capital requirements. And of course, it's also very highly regulated. Given all of that, do car makers really want to enter it?
It's a really good point. Now, we actually think that these factors may not be enough of a deterrent for car manufacturers, because insurance could be seen as an extension of existing propositions, given many car makers already offer financial products such as car finance and warranties. And for smart car makers, and you know, most car companies now manufacture smart vehicles, there are other strong advantages to owning an insurance subsidiary. So, for example, immediate access to accident claims data allows them to fine-tune the design of their cars, potentially reducing manufacturing costs and accident frequencies in the future. And also, offering competitively priced insurance allows makers of luxury vehicles such as Tesla to cut the overall cost of owning their cars. But I think you're right that some car makers may prefer not to actually underwrite insurance risks. They may be unwilling to expose themselves to the very costly claims related to severe bodily injury, which can take a very long time to settle. And in the US, they may be reluctant to navigate 50 separate state insurance regulators.
So tell me, Helena, how do you see things panning out over the next 10 to 20 years? Will car makers emerge as significant competitors to insurers?
It's really hard to say at this stage, but smart car makers' access to driving data, which we think will be critical to offering competitively priced insurance as smart cars become the norm, certainly puts them in a very strong position. And in the US, this has already helped some smart car makers negotiate distribution agreements with insurers, under which they collect a commission for every policy that they sell. And at the same time, they get access to accident data collected by insurers, which of course supports the design of future vehicles.
Are insurers entirely dependent on car makers for driving data?
No, not entirely. Some have access to data via their own telematics operations, and some car makers actually sell their driving data to third parties, which in turn make it available to insurers. So, you know, there are many forces at work here. But I guess the other important consideration is that smart cars' high tech safety features are likely to reduce accident frequencies over time, which will eventually erode traditional motor insurance premiums. So while the direct competitive impact of Tesla insurance is mild, we do see the company's emergence as an indication that the motor insurance industry is evolving and that insurers will need to adapt to remain relevant in a sort of a lower risk world.
Lena, I was just wondering, what kinds of things are insurers doing to maybe tilt things back in their favor?
So many traditional insurers are actively developing their own data-led underwriting using technology such as big data analytics and artificial intelligence to assess risk and set prices. And encouragingly, demand for telematics insurance is actually growing, particularly in the US market. But we would also expect them to look for alternative revenue sources, particularly as smart cars improve road safety and cut demand for insurance. Now, this could include providing protection against risks that are becoming more prevalent in the sort of the digital age. So by their very nature, smart cars are exposed to cyber risks. Security is a particular vulnerability, and possible threats include things like theft of the vehicle with someone taking over the remote system, or even endangering individuals' privacy by operating a microphone in the car. So insurers could generate earnings by providing protection against these new types of risks, or indeed offering risk prevention services, which would take them away from their traditional role of paying claims after the loss has already occurred.
I see. So we're really looking at perhaps an evolution of the nature of and the focus of auto insurance in the future. Helena and Miles, thank you so much. And thank you to Gideon and Mark as well. If you're listening to this podcast on a streaming service, please remember to follow or subscribe. And if you'd like to read any of the reports referenced in this podcast, you can find them by clicking the link to this episode at about.moodys.io/podcasts. While you're there, you can check out other Moody's Talks podcasts, including Securitization Spotlight, The Big Picture, Muniland, and Behind the Bonds. And please tune in again in 2 weeks on Wednesday, April 6th, for the next episode of Focus on Finance.